You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
In a new book about Canada's military, past and present, Ian McKay and Jamie Swift argue that the myth of Canada as a peaceable kingdom is being replaced by the story of Canada as a nation of warriors. The book is titled Warrior Nation: Rebranding Canada in an Age of Anxiety. The authors look back at past wars that Canada's fought in and forward to the changing role of the military in current-day Canadian society. Ian McKay is a history professor at Queen's University. Jamie Swift is an award-winning Canadian journalist, author, and activist. And Jamie Swift joins me now by phone from Ontario, Kingston to be precise, to tell us more about his book. Hello, Jamie, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Thanks for having me.
The subtitle of your book is Rebranding Canada in an Age of Anxiety. Let's start with the issue of rebranding Canada for new immigrants. You say the guide for new Canadians has changed substantially in recent years. What are those changes?
Well, the citizenship guide that's published has been published for years by the federal government and changed from time to time is the guide that new immigrants have to study and pass a test on before they become Canadian citizens. And in the version, the first version that the Harper government put out a few years ago, there is a major change in that the Canada that is presented is a country that's been all about war all the time. Particularly the section on Canadian history is predominantly about wars and soldiers and glorious battles. Previous editions of this snapshot of Canada did not emphasize war at all. Peacekeeping, the Canadian tradition of peacekeeping, has been relegated in the Harper government's version of the citizenship guide to half a sentence, just about as much as, or maybe a bit less than a move in the 1920s by some rather loopy Canadians to try to annex the West Indies as part of the Dominion of Canada. So that gives you a sense of the priorities of the government. The citizenship ceremony itself has been changed to the extent that it used to be the main symbolic figure at the citizenship ceremony used to be a Mountie in his red serge suit and Smokey the Bear hat. And now, whenever possible, they want to have a uniformed soldier there, preferably someone who had been to Afghanistan in Canada's longest war. And my understanding is now that if a citizenship judge is not available to conduct the swearing-in ceremony as well, a serving officer of the Canadian military can do the job. Funnily enough, sorry, just one more thing. I was up in Thunder Bay doing a book talk for this Warrior Nation book in September, and somebody told me that the citizenship ceremony that had happened there this past August was held on a Canadian warship. So I think that gives you a sense of the symbolic priorities that the current government has with respect to citizenship and new Canadians.
Are the soldiers at the ceremony now, do they have arms, weapons?
I'm not sure. I would doubt that. I would doubt that. Most of the soldiers you see, certainly in the streets of Kingston, CFB Kingston, Canadian Forces Base Kingston, is a major military installation, and you don't see soldiers armed walking around the streets by any means. I think it's much more about symbolism and the politics of image and symbolism, and trying to convince both new Canadians and those of us who've been lucky enough to be born in Canada that our past is all about war all the time, and our present and our future should also all be all about war all the time. There's a famous statement that says, he who controls the past controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past. And that was George Orwell in 1984. And I think we're confronted here with a very Big Brother-like government, a very authoritarian government, that is seeking to reimagine Canada, as Ian and I argue in this book, as a country that has been forged in fire. Listeners will remember this past summer and the barrage of propaganda around the 200th anniversary of the start of the War of 1812. The Olympics were saturated by that one ad about the War of 1812. And that cost us, you, me, $28 million, which is, you know, enough to pay for the Polar Environment Research Station that the Harperites tossed aside for, at least 20 years. So it gives a sense of their priorities, placing a huge amount of emphasis on reminiscence and the glory of war. And the images of war that one sees in the Citizenship Guide are very much antiseptic, and any horrors of war, the many horrors of war, the travesty that war is, are airbrushed out. So one gets the sense that war could be a jolly bit of fun in some way. So I find we find this notion quite disturbing.
Now, the notion that Canada has been a peacekeeping nation, you question that as well.
Well, we don't go for an overly romanticized notion of Canada as peacekeeper. We try to situate Canada's many peacekeeping and mostly its most important peacekeeping missions in their historical context, the 1956 Suez United Nations Emergency Force that Lester Pearson famously won the Nobel Prize for proposing, the intervention in the Congo. We point out that a Canadian officer was complicit in fingering Lumumba to the other side in the Congolese Civil War, and Lumumba, of course, was murdered there. We try to show that Canada has this peacekeeping tradition. We've been involved in many successful and important peacekeeping missions, but that peacekeeping, you have to understand each mission in particular, so that we don't want to offer a romanticized gloss about peacekeeping, but what we do want to try to get across is the argument that peacekeeping is important to the Canadian self-imagination. And we think it's important for a country and its political culture to imagine itself as a force for peace and reconciliation in the world, as opposed to a country that is all about war. So there's a difference between the nuts and bolts and the realpolitik of Canada's peacekeeping role, which has often been part of empire, and the really important ways that Canadians, we all understand ourselves. And the peacekeeping myth, which is myth in the sense of myths are stories that people tell themselves to understand the future, but we see a sustained conservative attack on the notion of peacekeeping as something that the Canadian military should get away from. And we situate the forces, the academics, the politicians, and the militarists who are trying to push those buttons.
You write about a strategy of the Canadian military called Operation Connection. What is Operation Connection?
Well, I don't know if it's still going on. It was started under the tutelage of the famous warrior general Rick Hillier, and he brags about it in his memoir as an effort that the military launched in the mid-2000s, 2006-07, to put Canadian military forces out in the community at every possible opportunity. So any time a hockey game is played, a big game, a football game, The Grey Cup, for instance, in Winnipeg in 2006, General Hillier himself was up on the Jumbotron, and there was a big flypast of jet planes, and they've deployed a huge number of public relations officers to help with community events and set up tents rights and things. So it's a very sort of American notion of having the military as part of the warp and woof of Canadian society. And we've really never seen that before in Canada. And that was launched, as I say, by General Hillier. And we still see it going on today. A year ago, when Canada was part of the NATO force that ostensibly bombed the Libyans to freedom, the Harper government staged a flypast of jet planes, fighter jets, over Parliament Hill, oddly enough, over the Peace Tower. And there were 21 gun salutes and this kind of thing. And it was really a relatively minor Canadian military adventure. But a huge amount of publicity was, they tried to make a huge thing of it. Luckily, people didn't really pay too much attention because they saw it as for the travesty that it was. $800,000 down the drain, that seems, you know, a bit of a waste at time, in a time of what we see, we're told, is great austerity. Tony Clement was arguing or boasting this past week about how many civil servants have been fired.
So how much is the Harper government spending on the military?
Well, I think military budgets are at a high point, a level they haven't been at since the end of the Cold War. They really got ramped up when the war in Kandahar started. There's been a leveling off. The military, of course, and their well-endowed backers will say there have been massive cuts, but really a lot of the cuts that they've experienced have been on paper. So they're about at the same level, and the conservative defense strategy, a white paper they put out a few years ago, they haven't climbed down from it. So the extent of the cuts that the military will face in the next budget cycle is still unknown. But you can be sure that if there are any cuts, we're going to be hearing the rusting out rhetoric again. And, of course, we still have the famous scandal of the F-35s and how many billions of dollars Canadians are going to be asked to spend on these fighter jets.
Little known probably to most Canadians is that the Harper government is in talks to establish permanent presence military bases in seven countries. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think what they're doing is they're not necessarily bases like the American bases all over the world, Guantanamo Bay, Korea, they still have forces in Germany, et cetera, et cetera. These are small forward operating posts where supplies can be deposited, et cetera, et cetera. It's new, but I think what's most important about it is that in Africa and the Middle East and East Asia or South Asia, it shows that the Canadian military anticipates that the next fields of operations, or in military terms, theaters, that was always been a puzzle to me, theaters, are going to be in the global south, and that they will be in some way akin to the tragic misadventure of Canada's war in Kandahar that I described as Canada's longest war. It was. And this Libyan bombing the Libyans to freedom, this kind of firefighting action. We don't see that Canada really has any enemies. We see Canada's real enemies as perhaps, global climate change, global hunger, these are what Canada should be setting its mind to attacking. Nobody's really set to attack us. So we question the logic of having this large-ish military establishment in a country that is essentially at peace. And this war in Kandahar, a total debacle, is winding down. So when wars wind down, you usually demobilize and start spending much less on the military. So we would say that would be a good idea.
Just to go back to Remembrance Day, November 11th, did you notice any impact of this rebranding in terms of the ceremonies the government promoted?
Well, I started working on this book in 2006, and I was attending various Remembrance Day ceremonies, and I do recall attending with my father in Montreal in the early 60s Remembrance Day ceremonies. He was a veteran of World War II. He was wounded in Normandy. And I recalled those ceremonies as certainly solemn, but maybe mournful, and about the tragedy of war, and not only the number of soldiers who died, but the number of civilians. The Remembrance Day ceremonies that I attended, it has much more of a militarist cast. There's usually reference to how Canadians who fought abroad in all of Canada's wars, and Canada's Governor General repeated this line about the War of 1812 when the propaganda was ramping up this past summer, that all of Canada's wars, back to the Boer War or putting down the Indian Mutiny, these were all about freedom. And this is a line that's repeated again and again and again. So if you can imagine that World War I was in any way about freedom, I may have a bridge over the East River between Brooklyn and Manhattan that I might want to sell to you, certainly the Boer War. So what's happening here is this subtle and often not too subtle attempt to convince us that every time Canada has gone to war, it's been to promote freedom and democracy. And this, of course, is a total lie.
I want to go back to the cover of your book. It has a photograph there of a Canadian officer riding a torpedo. It seems soldiers can't get away from the male soldiers from the phallic competition. And I don't know if that's Petraeus next to him standing beside him and laughing.
It is Petraeus, and the man astride the long, firm torpedo is Canada's former Chief of Defense Staff, Walt Natinchuk. It's taken at the Calgary Stampede. They're both wearing big Stetsons, so it is very sort of Texan and American. Petraeus is laughing. I guess poor old General Petraeus isn't laughing anymore, but that's another story for another day. The cultural riff, of course, is to Stanley Kubrick's classic anti-war film Doctor Strangelove from the 1960s, and the famous image of the American character actor Slim Pickens riding a nuclear bomb that had been dropped from a B-52, I believe, and waving his Stetson hat in the air and yelling, "Yahoo!" So that's we couldn't not put that picture on the front of the book because it's so symbolic, as you say, in a macho and almost phallic way, and it also talks about the way that the Canadian forces are now so integrated with the American forces, it's almost hard to tell that they're two different militaries.
Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we suggest people read the book for sure. Thank you very much, Jamie.
Thanks for having me on.
I've been speaking with Jamie Swift. He's co-author with Ian McKay of Warrior Nation, Rebranding Canada in an Age of Anxiety.